This Ed Harton, by the way. And, there are so many things that I wanted to have a look at today, including the world of magic mushrooms, which is quite a world. And I'm speaking of real mushrooms, not cactus buds. A terrifying trip for some people, you might say. And then there's a new book by Gore Vidal, whose name alone is controversial enough, not to speak of some of the things that he writes of. But the book is called Rocking the Boat. And a few of the Vidal quotations that were picked up by Newsweek this week. Here's one. Until the rise of American advertising, it never occurred to anyone anywhere in the world that the teenager was a captive in a hostile world of adults, with his own morality and language. His difference from the world of adults a source of pride. To cause division between age groups is something new. American advertising has achieved it. So says Gore Vidal, who also says, it is certainly better to be non-ruled by mediocrities than enslaved by Caesars. And one more. He says, here is the real tragedy of commercialism. Discard automatically any idea or theme which is not acceptable to the prejudices of an audience that must be won by flattery and charm. No American dramatist in the last war would have written with such virulence against the president as Aristophanes wrote against the Athenian establishment at a time of war and national disaster. Well, a few of the things that Gore Vidal had to say in his new book, Rocking the Boat, and he certainly rocked it a few times. And in the Brave New World Department, there is something that is, I suppose, the most fantastic thing since the invention of the wheel. It has been invented primarily as an artist concept so far, but they're hoping that this will be a great vehicle for delivering things for the U.S. Army, for example, over rough terrain, terrain on which the wheel would have too much difficulty. And this is an actual walking vehicle. And how does it walk? That thing which, that action which a baby of anywhere from 9 to 15 months learns almost automatically, partly by imitation and partly by instinct. Well, the machine doesn't have exactly a brain of its own to do it. It copies, too. The operator walks. He walks on a sort of treadmill affair, I suppose, because he isn't actually propelling the vehicle anywhere. But there are many different sensors attached to the different parts of his legs that feed a signal into the machine, which in effect says, go thou and do likewise, so that the machine actually mimics the actions of the human being in walking. Well, that is a fantastic thing. It was conceived by the Ordnance Department of General Electric, and it looks even more fantastic on paper. And just a very brief salute, you probably read in, well, in your newspaper or in the National Observer or the Wall Street Journal or Time or Newsweek or whatever you read, about a woman named Dr. Kelsey, Dr. Frances Oldham Kelsey. She's with the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. And it's so fashionable to throw rocks at bureaucracy, and a few rocks were thrown at her. I think that it is only fair to indulge in a quiet salute to a woman who saved an untold amount of tragedy for American mothers. And I'm referring, of course, to that sleeping pill called thalidomide, which was boosted in West Germany and which was going to be boosted in this country, except that Dr. Kelsey just had a nagging suspicion that this drug had not been thoroughly tested. And she kept telling the pharmaceutical company, sure, your research on animals points out the surprising fact that it doesn't put animals to sleep at all, although it does put human beings to sleep. And you say that the work on animals also proves that it's non-toxic. Well, obviously, the effect on animals is different from the effect on human beings. So how can you say that it's non-toxic just because it hasn't caused any deaths among animals? Well, of course, the tragedy finally broke before Dr. Kelsey broke. It never was approved for use in this country. But in Germany, quite a few thousand children were born, either with no arms or with no legs, hopelessly malformed. And, of course, the tragedy was prevented by the vigilance of Dr. Kelsey and the resistance to pressure. And the pressure can get tremendous when you're in a seat such as the one she was sitting in. Robert Graves is a poet of considerable note, and at the same time has a hobby that is, I'm sure, a fascinating one, and that is the study of mushrooms. I don't mean how they taste in a souffle or anything like that. He means the study of mushrooms in human religions, or especially in religions that concentrate on trances and mysteries. He also has studied a great deal about why there are so many taboos surrounding mushrooms. I mentioned at the beginning of the program that we would talk a bit about magic mushrooms today, so-called magic. They're so-called magic, but they're not so-called mushrooms. These are real mushrooms. These are not the cactus buds that are used in some other religions. In the August issue of Holiday Magazine, Robert Graves wrote under the title A Journey to Paradise an account of what happened to him and several other people during a trance induced by mushrooms. This happened on a January evening in New York City, where four friends had gathered in an apartment overlooking the East River. They were prepared to set out with Robert Graves under the guidance of the host. Now, the Greeks had a word for this host. He was the mystagogue, that meaning a priest who took charge of initiates at the sacred mysteries of Eleusis or Corinth or Samothrace. And the mystagogue had advised all of them to fast beforehand, to drink no liquor, and to clear their consciences. Now, this was not some nut who had wandered in robe and sandals to take over. This was R.G. Wasson, the host. He was a vice president of Morgan Guaranty Trust, and he's an internationally recognized expert on mushrooms. And he and Graves had been writing for quite a while on what they call mycophobia, that is, an unreasoning fear of mushrooms, something that you find among whole populations in Europe and Asia and Africa. And that presumably was how they got together, their mutual interest in mushrooms. These people were prepared for a pretty brave journey, the kind of journey that some people undertake quite lightly, who go in and get hypnotized by parlor practitioners, or who are willing to take this pill or that mushroom in order to see what kind of strange sensation they might get out of it, tampering with the mental or emotional processes. But about 7:30 in the evening, everybody there was given a preparation made from a mushroom called the psilocybe. And at 8 o'clock, they began turning out the lights, and all the guests settled down in easy chairs and waited for a revelation. Pretty soon, there wasn't too much sound in the room, just the cars passing along the drive. And Graves began to feel a numbness in his arms and a prickling at the nape of his neck. And in the half light that filtered through the shutters, he began to see colored dots on the ceiling. They shone more when he closed his eyes. They all began to shiver. Their pulses slowed down. That apparently is one of the effects of this mushroom. They were given blankets, and they remembered the warning from their host that you are going where God dwells and will be granted all knowledge. Whoever nurses evil in his heart sees hideous demons and nameless horrors, more proper to hell than to paradise, and wishes he had never been born. And Graves began to think, as the first effects of the mushroom took hold, what were his motives? What was his inner state like? Was he likely to see demons, or was he likely to see a kind of paradise? Well, the half-light became uncomfortably strong for his eyes. He kept them closed. And he knew, having studied mysteries and having studied entrances to a paradise induced by a drug, he knew that the road to that paradise would very often begin under the sea or from a lake bottom. So when he began to see greenish water lapping around him, he wasn't at all surprised. He entered a marble grotto, passing by a pile of massive sunken statuary, and found himself in a high-roofed tunnel lit by brilliantly colored lamps. Behind him was the sea. This, he said, was a kind of schizophrenia. Here was his corporeal self, his body, reclining in a chair, fully conscious. He was talking once in a while with the friends who were in the room. But another Robert Graves had entered that tunnel. He was still worrying about how many demons he was going to see. And he glanced up at the roof, and he saw thousands of pink and green and yellow faces like carnival masks grimacing down. But he just dismissed them with a wave of his hand. And they vanished very obligingly, with the kind of demons that some people see in dreams. Then he turned, as the tunnel turned, and he came to a domed treasury. And he said this was a very familiar element of paradises that show up in many religions, whether it be Hindu or Babylonian or Hebrew or Icelandic or Irish or Greek or Chinese, this great treasury central to the paradise. And he said that a fantastic treasure was heaped before him. Diadems and tiaras and necklaces and crosses and breastplates and goblets and cups and platters and scepters. They all blazed, they twinkled, and even richer than those jewels were the royal silks spread out for inspection in blue and mulberry and white, vast lengths of them miraculously brocaded with birds and beasts and flowers. He was reminded of the time when he with his sisters had been waiting what seemed endlessly in a cold, dark hall, and suddenly the drawing room door was flung open and there blazed the Christmas tree in all its Christmas tree glory. That was what it reminded him of. He was still in a trance, and he reached for a notebook. And this is something that happens to so many people when they take a drug-induced trance. And by the way, this particular drug, Robert Graves, Graves claims, is not habit-forming. They begin to make notes, or that is, they want to make notes. All the wonderful revelation, all the ability to solve the problems of the world, the knowledge of good and evil that seem to come to them in these trances, they want to capture, so that when the trance is over, they will be able to transfer this wonderful knowledge into their usual, everyday, non-drugged state. And the experience is usually the same with just about all of them. He wrote down something in his notebook. He wrote down, 9 p.m., visions of, and that's all he wrote. That's all that he was going to be able to carry forward with him out of the trance. He says that things were happening too fast, and the pen began to feel strange in his hand. And he remembers saying, I have seen enough treasure for a lifetime. Is there no human beauty in paradise? And this being a paradise, he was to see what he asked for. All the treasures vanished, and instead there was a row of lovely and live and naked caryatids, those sculptured female figures so often used in the architecture of the Renaissance, except that these were alive, not made of marble or plaster. Their faces were shrouded, and yet Graves hesitated to step forward and touch any of this loveliness, because he was afraid that these beautiful maidens would be transformed into something hideous. This had happened in legends before, so he dismissed them and emerged from the tunnel into daylight. And here, he said, was a kind of Eden on top of a mountain. Jewel-bright trees, flowers, pellucid streams. He said he experienced not only the bliss of innocence, but also what he called the knowledge of good and evil. That is, a universal understanding of all things, whether they were good or evil. He felt that suddenly his mind was so unfettered, so agile, that he could solve any problem in the world. He had immediate access to all knowledge everywhere. But he didn't try to write it down, he said, because at the time the sensation of wisdom was enough. Why should he try to exploit it? And then, he said, an unseen voice began to sing. It was a woman's voice. In paradise, there would have to be a goddess. This hidden woman scolded and entreated and commanded and coaxed and went off into quarter-tone harmony and sounds more beautiful than he had ever seen or heard, because he did begin to see these sounds. The notes becoming intricate links of a solid golden chain that would coil and loop among the jade-green bushes. Each song was followed by a pause, and each time he said he was in a lover's agony, wondering if the song would begin again. And the notes would fall to earth, rise and soar, and his spirit followed after the notes into the clear blue air, gazing down on cornfields and fields of poppies and the spires of a heavenly city. And at last the music ended. The visions were beginning to fade, He stretched and woke up. He said he joined the other people who had been in the same kind of trance in the kitchen, and he asked them what they had seen. One of them saw a huge, slow-moving fish in the sea. Another saw demons enough to cause weeping and wailing and sobbing. Another saw enormous buildings in an architectural style that he couldn't place. And another saw blueprints of a simple joy. And he said that there was a very curious bond of affection among all the people who had undergone the experience. Now, Robert Graves, poet though he is, says that he is not a mystic. He said that none of his friends were either, that they had visited paradise by what many Orthodox members of recognized religions would call the back stairs. He said that most religions hold that the only way to achieve paradise legitimately is by humility, by self-denial, and by meditation, by a long and rigorous discipline for controlling the appetites of the body, a sort of separation from the bodily self. He said that these mystics who have seen this kind of paradise very frequently run into trouble with the authorities, unless once in a while they have the talent to illuminate that paradise-like vision and pass it on to other people, like St. John of the Cross or Vaughan or Blake or Van Gogh. And he said then they are valued as great souls, but only long after their death. Graves believes in his study of ancient religions and the forerunners of present religions that perhaps man's first glimpse of paradise came through that so-called back stairs, that man's first look at this place where all was serene and all was perfect and all was suffused in an ineffable joy almost incapable of being described, that man's first look at that may have come through an eating of the mushroom, of the particular kinds of mushroom that can induce this kind of trance, and that only later was it believed that by self-denial and all the disciplines that we have outlined could man see that same paradise without any aid from a mushroom. And you wonder sometimes, looking at so many populations where mushrooms of all kinds are considered not only inedible but loathsome, where they are given names like toadstool, for example, which was as loathsome a name as could be concocted among some peoples. Why, he said, was it perhaps a sort of taboo? Were the nectar and ambrosia of Greek legend maybe actually a hallucinogenic mushroom, which was supposed to be reserved for royalty because a man achieved a godlike stature after eating it? Well, those are conjectures, of course. As Graves has studied the mushroom, the kind that was used by the Korjaks in eastern Siberia in primitive days for inducing hallucinations, the kind that was referred to by Lewis Carroll in Alice in Wonderland, there is a mushroom called flycap, which is supposed to produce a drunken delirium accompanied by extraordinary physical strength and erotic energy and insensitivity to pain, supposed to cause a man to speak wildly, to lose all sense of time or space. On the other hand, he said, this mushroom, psilocybe, P-S-I-L-O-C-Y-B-E, that grows in Mexico, is supposed to convey a person to paradise without dulling his wits or turning him into a beast. And he said that around Oaxaca, where this secret ritual takes place at night, on the mud floor of an Indian hut, decorum is the watchword. And this is not a wild and drunken orgy where all the barriers are down. No, he said, whatever barriers are lowered are barriers within the human mind. He said that there are sentries posted outside against any interruption, that the altar reflects a blending of a primitive understanding of Christianity along with the actual primitive elements, parrot feathers and red flowers and turkey eggs and so on. He said the ritual may vary between villages, but there is always an officiation by a curandero, or curandera if it happens to be a woman, and it is a solemn officiation, with each person given a dose of the mushroom that is supposed to be all that he can take and no more. He said that in his study of mushroom cultures, in his study, for example, of pre-Columbian cultures in this country, religions, that is, religions that were not supposed at that time to have been tainted at all by any contact with Europeans, he said that he found surprising similarities in these cultures that had arisen independently. He said, looking at the Mazatec Indians, for example, looking at some of the others, he said there are similarities between Tlalocan and the old world paradises. He said that these similarities may not have come from a contact between Europeans and the ancient Mexican Indians. He said, indeed, it may have been just that they had this common hallucinogenic food, this food that could induce hallucinations. He said that you go back to Thrace and see Dionysus the Thunderer, and he could be called the twin of this figure in Mexican mushroom mythology. Well, it goes into many parts of the world, this reverence for the trance that can be induced by certain kinds of mushroom, the flycap among others, and some of the others that we have mentioned. In Etruscan pictures and artifacts, you see a representation of them. You find it in Guatemala, you find it in Portugal, you find it in many parts of Europe and North America too. And he said that the food of the gods, which is referred to in so many ancient religions, may indeed have been one or another of this family of mushrooms that can induce this kind of hallucination. Now, so far, it would sound very much as if Robert Graves hoped to have the mushroom concession at the next big party somewhere, and that he is going all out for mushrooms and for the trances that can be induced by certain kinds of them. He said it's not that way. He said that actually a poetic trance, that is a non-drug-induced trance, which he has been able to go into on occasion by concentration, is much more valuable to him because actual work comes out of it and because it is something that he has earned. This, he said, is far more valuable to him than any mushroom trance. He said that he feels no urge to revisit that paradise, ineffably beautiful though it was. Well, that's what Robert Graves had to say in the August issue of Holiday magazine about his experience with the mushroom. And my time is up. Back to the forest, I suppose. This is Ed Hart. Thank you and good morrow. This is KFI, Los Angeles.
Roll jet smooth through a summer's day. Roll jet smooth, that's the Chevrolet way. Come on, get out, see the USA. Roll jet smooth in Chevrolet.
Summer's here, vacation roads are calling. And what better way to get out and see the USA than behind the wheel of a jet smooth Chevrolet? This summer, there's more reason than ever to make that happy trip to your Chevrolet dealer. There's a wide selection of models with a host of options, accessories, and power teams that let you tailor your Chevrolet exactly to your fancy at modest extra cost. See your Chevrolet dealer.
Roll jet smooth in Chevrolet.